It's a great pleasure to be back here at the First Church where I last spoke a couple of years ago, and to be here this time on Charter Day. This year's theme for Charter Day is to reflect upon the treasures left for us by the founders of New England. Well, what do we mean by treasures? A few weeks ago, my wife and I spent a day in Philadelphia viewing the traveling King Tut exhibit. We were amazed at the beauty and the number of the antiquities on display. These extraordinary physical artifacts of past time, objects that reveal something of the wealth, skills, and aesthetics of the society that created them, are what we normally think of as treasures. In a small way, there are similar physical treasures that illuminate 17th century New England. One thinks of the silver communion cup given to this church by John Winthrop, the Davenport communion cup recently loaned to an exhibit at the Stamford Historical Society, and some of the finely crafted furniture that was part of the wonderful exhibit organized by the Boston Museum of Fine Arts in 1982. But the most valuable treasures of colonial New England are not made of gold, silver, or even wood. As perhaps befits a society that prides itself even today on its intellectual preeminence, the true treasures bestowed upon us by the Puritan founders of this region were crafted from words. Among the most notable are the Massachusetts Bay Charter, which allowed the early colonists the freedom to shape a society that they hoped would be as a city upon a hill. John Winthrop's lay sermon on Christian charity, which set forth the ideals of communal cooperation and caring, which he urged his fellow settlers to adopt. The covenant of the First Church of Boston and those of the other congregations of the Bay that entrusted the future of the churches to the membership itself as opposed to a small group of leaders. The Constitution of the New England Confederation, which gave later generations of Americans a model of how different governments with unique characteristics but common goals could unite together to achieve more than any one of them could achieve on its own. And finally, in this list, and one could make it much longer, the Cambridge Platform, which codified a New England way of church authority that sought to preserve religious unity while not imposing total uniformity. Each of these statements and documents had an important role in fostering the growth and stability of colonial New England. Some of New England's treasures can be visited. You can see the armor worn in the 17th century by Fitzjohn Winthrop in a display case at the Massachusetts Historical Society. Some of you have likely seen the Massachusetts Charter on exhibit at the Commonwealth Museum. There are many printed editions of Winthrop's sermon, the Cambridge Platform, and church covenants of the time. And we may be tempted to look upon these as we do the artifacts preserved behind glass, viewing them with reverence and reflecting upon them as evidence of how fortunate New England was to have such founders. Some of these statements of the founders are actually now merely artifacts of that past, just as John Winthrop's communion cup and his grandson's armor. The Massachusetts Bay Charter ceased to have an active role in the governance of the region when it was revoked by the English Crown in 1684. The New England Confederation served its purpose but came to an end with the merger of the colonies into the short-lived but autocratic Dominion of New England of the late 1680s. But other founding statements remain operative and are part of a usable past. John Winthrop's motto of Christian charity is still one of the most quoted speeches in American public life, referred to by Harvard's Reverend Peter Gomes as the greatest sermon of the past millennium. Almost a decade ago, I was privileged to speak across the river at the celebration of the 350th anniversary of the Cambridge Platform, another part of our usable past. I marveled at the number of churches and variety of denominations that claimed that statement of congregational governance for their own. And here at the First Church, new members are still asked to accept the covenant that John Winthrop, Anne Hutchinson, and so many illustrious other individuals swore to over 375 years ago. It is two of these founder statements that I wish to focus on today. And because I am back at the First Church, I wish to use the history of this congregation to illustrate the point that I will get to. John Winthrop's lay sermon and the covenant of the First Church each speaks in its own way to the importance of community. But community in the 1600s was not to be taken for granted, just as it should not be today. One of the most important findings of the past few decades of research into Puritanism is the realization that there was no monolithic entity that we can call Puritanism. The first settlers of Massachusetts came from different parts of England and brought with them different varieties of their faith. John Winthrop came from the Stour Valley, where the temporary ascendancy of the godly had given Puritans the assurance necessary to allow and even encourage discussion of a variety of paths to religious truth. The Dudleys, the Leverets, and others who came from Lincolnshire and its surroundings had shaped their faith in holy huddles, surrounded by hostile forces. Feeling embattled and threatened, they were focused on defending the boundaries between accepted truths and any new ideas which might undermine those truths. London Puritans, such as the Dyers and the Canes, had lived in a complex and crowded religious world in which men and women who were unhappy with the preaching of their local pastor had to do little more than cross the street to find different counsel. Some of these Londoners found the diversity of the metropolis exhilarating. Others saw it as frightening. And this merely hints at the many forms of Puritan experience found among the early settlers. The goal of John Winthrop and his fellow leaders was to form a single community out of the various groups and families that arrived in Massachusetts. It was a goal clearly laid out in his lay sermon on Christian charity. The colonists were, he reminded them, a company professing ourselves knit together by the bond of love and the exercise of it. They were to delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, but always having before our eyes our commission and community in the work, our community as members of the same body. We must, he insisted, love brotherly without dissimulation. We must love one another with a pure heart fervently. In July of 1630, Winthrop, together with the Reverend John Wilson, Thomas Dudley, and others, gathered in Charleston to organize a church, forming a covenanted community of men and women, quote, solemnly and religiously promising and binding ourselves to walk in all ways according to the rule of the gospel and in all sincere conformity to his holy ordinances and in mutual love and respect each to other, so near God shall give us grace. Later that year, the church moved to Boston, becoming the first church in that town, this church. The challenge that faced the members of the First Church was how to agree on what the rule of the gospel was and what were the holy ordinances to be observed. They had to employ an image that I have been using in my recent work to identify where to place the perimeter fence that divided acceptable views and practices from those that threatened the nature and survival of their holy experiment. This was more challenging than what we might imagine, because not only did the members of the church bring with them a variety of understandings of their faith, but the discussion was constantly being joined by new arrivals from England, such as John Cotton, the Dyers, the Keynes, and the Hutchinsons, men and women who came from different regions, who had different experiences of godly enterprises, particularly as the English religious situation was evolving. Following the resulting debates, some Bostonians found themselves outside the perimeter fence, looking in. Many writers in our time like to bash the Puritans as bigots and religious terrorists even. They draw a contrast between what they see as Puritan intolerance and what they like to portray as the total religious freedom to be found in modern America. But this is foolish on a number of counts, not the least of which is that it oversimplifies what was going on at the time. And those who smugly sneer at the Puritans are mistaken in their assumption that people are free to do and say whatever they wish in modern America. The fact is that there are limits to what one can preach and practice in our time. Over 100 years ago, for instance, Americans decided that polygamy was not acceptable as a practice in the churches of this nation. The issue is not whether a society needs a perimeter fence, but where to place it and how high to build it. And we need to bear that in mind as we review the contentions of the Puritan era. Over the course of the 17th century, the First Church was involved in a number of debates and disputes that involved defending or relocating the perimeter fence around their godly enterprise. Each of these pitted different groups against one another, each group believing that it had found the truth and needed to preclude alternative versions. Each of these disputes tested the charity of the then members of this church. The two that we will look at show the ease with which men and women seeking to preserve the purity of a community can end up rupturing the community they sought to defend. The most famous controversy was the one that surrounded Anne Hutchinson. To fully understand this in terms of the community that was the Boston Church, we need to look more carefully than many do at what came before the dispute and what came after it. Often overlooked is the fact that during the first months after the arrival of Henry Vane, the Hutchinsons, and others who expressed views soon viewed as controversial, there was no sign of dissension within the congregation. Both those who suggested a broader understanding of grace and those who were worried about the antinomian possibilities of such ideas seemed to recognize the root of the matter in those who disagreed with them. In the effort to see through a glass darkly, they valued open discussion as advancing better understanding. In short, the First Church was willing to define itself, to set its perimeter fence in a way that allowed the discourse between these differing members to aid in everyone's search for truth. But when the new views were attacked by Thomas Shepard and others from outside the community, a polarizing process began which pitted those who believed in free grace against those whom, including their own pastor John Wilson and most of the colony's other clergy, the newcomers accused of preaching a covenant of works. As the dispute within the church progressed, neither the supporters of Anne Hutchinson nor her opponents advocated toleration. Each asserted that their position and their position alone represented God's order. In the end, as we all know, Anne Hutchinson and some of her principal supporters left the colony, and the First Church excommunicated Mistress Hutchinson. The location of the perimeter fence had been reset, and brotherly love no longer extended to those who were deemed outside it. Or did it? There is more to be said to this story. As the controversy roiled the waters of the colony, disrupting the political order as well as the peace of the churches, some individuals, sought to recapture the middle ground that had been abandoned by the two factions. John Wilson and John Cotton were reconciled and came together in statements that indicated that they all agreed, as Cotton put it, about magnifying the grace of God, one party seeking to advance the grace of God within us and the other to advance the grace of God towards us. John Winthrop shared a statement about his own religious experience, which horrified Thomas Shepard and served as an implicit warning to call a halt to the search for hidden heresies. John Davenport, who had arrived in the colony just as the controversy erupted, labored to bring the opposing sides together, and in the church trial of Anne Hutchinson, for a time he seemed to have brought her to a restatement of her views which would have been acceptable to the majority. As a result of these efforts, many of those who had been outspoken supporters of Vane and Hutchinson, including members of Anne's own family, rethought their positions. They not only chose to stay in the Boston church, but they joined in the decision to pass a sentence of excommunication on her. We also need to remember that excommunication as practiced at this time was not a method of permanently casting someone out of the community. It was a punishment the purpose of which was to shock the offender into reconciliation. In point of fact, in 1640, this church sent three emissaries to Rhode Island in an attempt to bring their wandering sheep back into the fold of orthodoxy. Anne refused to acknowledge the church that had sent them as a true church and rejected their overtures. But it should be noted that others, including her eldest son Edward, did return to Massachusetts and made peace with the church. So those who falsely present the dispute as a clash between bigotry and intolerance ignore the positive steps taken to keep the fissure in this rock from becoming as deep as it might have become. About three decades later, the church was again riven into two factions. The failure of the rising generation to experience God's caress and present themselves for full membership in the church had threatened the success of the Puritan experiment in America. When young men and women reached maturity, were they still under the umbrella of the covenant and still subject to the disciplinary authority of the church if they had not been born again? And what was to happen to their own offspring if baptism continued to be limited to the children of those accepted into full communion? John Wilson, who was still pastor of the congregation, persuaded the majority to allow adults who had been baptized as youth to affirm their acceptance of the covenant. But the majority of the congregation refused to go further to adopt the halfway covenant, a reform whereby baptism would have been extended to the children of these young adults. The dispute over the halfway covenant made it impossible for the congregation to agree on a replacement for their teacher John Norton when that clergyman died in 1663. Following the death of John Wilson in 1667, the congregation was without a minister. The majority insisted on calling as pastor John Davenport of New Haven, one of the most distinguished clergymen of the founding generation, but the leading opponent of the halfway covenant. In doing so, the majority overrode the objections of the strong minority that supported baptismal reform. The result was a bitter fight that led eventually to the separation of the dissidents and the founding of the Third Church in Boston. What had begun as a dispute over the baptism of children soon evolved into a more complex argument over the nature of congregational governance. Davenport had been far more open to different views when he debated with Anne Hutchinson. Now he and the First Church majority denied the legitimacy of the new church, and the dispute ruptured the peace of the colony. Again, the communion of saints had been sundered. Again, the question to be asked is, where was that brotherly love which Winthrop had extolled? In this case, during the lifetime of the key actors, there were no overtures to reconcile the differences. That would take many more years. Both of these tales tell us something about the difficulty of forging a community of strong believers, and about the ways in which a community can be destroyed by those who claim to seek its perfection. It can be argued that this occurred because of the failure of fallible men and women to heed some of the other parts of the message contained in the Council of Winthrop Sermon and the First Church Covenant. In his model of Christian charity, John Winthrop expressed the hope that if the Puritans labored to serve God in New England, they would, as he put it, see much more of his wisdom, power, and goodness and truth than formerly we have been acquainted with. And in the covenant of this church, those who subscribe to it then pledge to do the right thing, so near God shall give us grace. Both of these statements point to an important lesson, that the search for the kingdom of God is a search for greater enlightenment. Or, as the words of the hymn we just sang say, revelation is not sealed. These Puritan founders did not offer a set blueprint for perfection, but a call to a never-ending search for better understanding. Failure to remember this led to the disruption of the Christian community of this church in the 1630s and again in the early 1670s. And in each instance, those who left the congregation were as unwilling to compromise as those who waved them goodbye. Over time, the members of the First Church have shown that they have learned these lessons. A few years ago, the congregation voted to extend its charity backwards in time by revoking the excommunication of Anne Hutchinson. More fundamentally, the search for truth pursued by generation after generation of members has expanded the bounds of the perimeter fence to the point where religious views are deemed acceptable here that the original members would not have recognized, much less accepted. The treasures we have been talking about are counterfeit if we simply put them in a case to admire. They are living treasures which need to be constantly considered and applied if they are to have value. In this church, and in the broader world in which we all live and strive, as we move to the future, we need to couple our search for a community of Christian charity with the knowledge history teaches us that we are fallible. And we need to always remind ourselves that arrogance is destructive of the ever better but never perfect community the founders called us to labor towards.